From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
The Republican-controlled Texas Supreme Court unanimously ruled against a challenge to Senate Bill 8, the nation's most restrictive abortion law, which bans abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected around 6 weeks, making no exception for rape or incest.
Playing politics with women's lives is turning into an Olympic-level sport in Texas. Odious restrictions combined with threats to providers and even family members of pregnant women who need reproductive care have led to lawsuits brought by, among others, concerned faith leaders and groups. On this week's show, an up-close look at the situation with the Reverend Daniel Cantor of Dallas.
What does it mean to be a prophetic voice?
Coming to a community and telling the community things it doesn't always want to hear. Prophets are not popular.
Well, I think a prophet in politics is someone who sees what others are blind to.
An award-winning set of documentary films highlights five essential leaders from the past century, with profiles of Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King Jr., and three others. Martin Doublemire's Prophetic Voices series is an invaluable look at the kind of change makers we've been blessed with and so desperately need today. I'm looking forward to meeting the filmmaker later in this hour.
From scholarly responses where people are really digging into the theology and writing dissertations about it, and then street actions where people are at a subway station offering ashes.
As Christians observe the holy season of Lent, there are important efforts afoot to bridge manufactured divisions within and among communities of faith and identity. The Reverend Marion Edmonds Allen leads the nonprofit Parity and will be back with us to discuss ways this time of year can help all of us see the humanity and sacredness we share with each other.
I'm Rick Hurstein at the intersection of religion, politics, and this. The single-minded, religious right-driven frenzy to deprive women of their constitutional right to reproductive services continues to escalate state by state. We address the desperate situation in Texas on this week's show, but virtual clones of the so-called six-week heartbeat bill are turning up in Republican-dominated state legislatures, including Idaho, just signed by the governor there, and an even more extreme version incubating in Tennessee. Multiple states are also working to pass laws that require women to receive patently false medical information, forcing waiting periods and multiple clinic visits, and even creating a new category of humans, fetal personhood, all while defunding providers that serve millions of low-income women. While the prayers of the far right are being answered, the rest can ponder just how confident most of us were, not long ago, that people would never let this happen. Meanwhile, a nominee for the highest court in the land, a body charged with the awesome responsibility of fairly and impartially protecting the rights of every American, religious and secular, got to hear this question from a sitting U.S. senator during Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation hearings this week.
So, on a scale of 1 to 10, how faithful would you say you are in terms of religion?
At least the judge had an answer that sounded way more American than the question.
I am reluctant to talk about my faith in this way just because I want to be mindful of the need for the public to have confidence in my ability to separate out my personal views.
And having thoroughly alienated millions of young people with relentless, politicized, and hate-filled hijacking of religion's moral authority, some conservative Christian groups this week have launched a national campaign to fix all that with a $100 million advertising blitz. It aims to resurrect the image, not of organized religion, heaven forbid, but of Jesus, who might have had a better suggestion for what to do with $100 million right about now.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now to our first guest. When a court rejected desperate faith-based pleas to halt the outrageous trampling of women's rights in Texas earlier this month, it was just the latest in a series of unthinkable violations of family privacy and personal conscience in a state that used to pride itself on rugged individualism. Well, it's quite literally now a nanny state, deeply involved in both the legal challenges and direct assistance to women being hurt by the arbitrary decisions. Is the Reverend Daniel Cantor, a Dallas pastor, and I am very pleased to have him with us today. Daniel, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Gaddy. I'm glad to participate in this conversation with you.
For those unfamiliar with the situation in Texas, would you just briefly summarize the challenge currently facing women who need reproductive care there?
Right. And just to put some context in it, so about 6 years ago, I founded a volunteer chaplaincy, a multi-faith chaplaincy, and Southwestern Women's Surgical Clinic here in Dallas. I was invited in by a member of my church who was working there to just go and do a blessing. And I'm running a big church, so I couldn't just run up there and do it. So we founded this sustainable volunteer chaplaincy. We had rabbis and Methodists and Presbyterians and Unitarian Universalists. And we're all pastors of churches. So we take our volunteer time and go sit with patients, families, even the staff. And we were just doing pastoral care with them.
Sure.
That clinic was seeing 100 patients a day for 6 days a week before SB 8. When SB 8, not all of them had abortions because some people didn't need them. Some people weren't pregnant, you know, but 100 patients would come through the doors. SB 8 hit. It dropped down to about 30 patients, all of them scared, all of them not knowing what was going on. About half of them were actually legitimate pre-6 week pregnancies. And so I went up to the clinic. It was a quiet day in the clinic post SB 8 and said, what's happening? Where are all these patients? And they said, most of them have misinformation. They think abortion's illegal. The other half are coming in even before they know they are pregnant. You know, the 6 week ban gives you about a week to discern whether you are pregnant or not. Mm-hmm. The 5 to 6 week, right? So I said to them, well, what's going to happen to all these patients? And we decided, and I said to them, how about we start bringing them to New Mexico? So at the current moment, we are bringing 20 patients every 2 weeks to a clinic in New Mexico for a safe and legal abortion. But just do the math on that. 20 patients every 2 weeks is a little different than 1,200 patients who would come through the doors of one clinic in one city serving Northeast Texas. So the harm to people's lives is incredible.
Oh, it's I'm so glad that you gave us that knowledge. Talk about, if you would, the recent lawsuit that you were a part of.
Yeah, so I was invited in to be a plaintiff on the case against SB 8. It was two clergy. Interestingly, they called all the when it went up through the circuit and kept going up toward the Supreme Court, they called all the plaintiffs except the two clergy. I don't think they wanted to, they don't want any callers in the witness box. Mm-hmm. But the lawyer, and I'm not a lawyer, so what I understand about it is that the law now is pretty much dead. And our interpretation is that they're just waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on the Mississippi case, at which point we're looking at, 26 states in the country having restrictive abortion laws. And we're almost, at this point, we're organizing and thinking forward to that crisis, that public health crisis, mm-hmm. That family crisis that even extends way beyond Texas. Because if you think about it, every state from Texas, from El Paso to the Atlantic Ocean below the Mason-Dixon line is going to have illegal laws. Mm-hmm. We're going to have illegal laws in the Dakotas. We're going to have illegal laws in Arizona, maybe Wisconsin, certainly Ohio, Iowa, Idaho, Pennsylvania, possibly New Hampshire. It's going to be a crisis we haven't seen in this country around a very simple medical procedure that every person who's pregnant should have a right to have. Mm-hmm. So the case that, to go back to your question, we watched that case get tossed around to the circuit court, to the Supreme Court, to the Texas Supreme Court. And we knew all along they were trying to chip away at it and basically delay of game until the Mississippi case, the Dobbs case, can be ruled on. Because that's the one that's going to challenge Roe v. Wade. Sure, we know how the Supreme Court is ruling. They're ruling ideologically on issues beyond abortion. I mean, the Supreme Court ruled on an issue about who can visit a death row inmate and decided that only a Christian pastor could visit, not a Muslim pastor. I mean, these are ideologically driven Supreme Court decisions, and we should all be scared about that. And so we're pretty clear the abortion case is going to go up in a heap of smoke. And we're just going to be fighting them on every state that wants to put these restrictive laws in. We're concerned about felony laws of aiding and abetting. At the moment, the aid and abet law, SB 8, allows us to help someone get a safe and legal abortion beyond the border of Texas. Whether they start regulating borders. I mean, can you imagine checkpoints at airports? And, what are we going to be doing? Sonograms on women as they go through security? This should concern every single human being in America. Because this is a freedom. These are freedom issues. As you started, these are freedom issues. Yeah. And not only that, but, we started this SBA case as clergy saying, there's a freedom of religion issue here.
That's right.
They're restricting what I can talk to people about in my own office, in the privacy of the confessional here in the office. Mm-hmm. So these things are very concerning. Even if you don't agree with abortion, if you hate abortion, you should still be scared about the kinds of laws they're trying to make around this, because it's chipping away at our sovereignty.
I find it superbly inspiring that you and the other faith leaders are not only standing with, but quite literally walking with, pregnant women abandoned by Texas politicians. I wish you would talk about that ministry.
Yeah. So it's a deep and abiding pastoral ministry that we're doing. We've got over 100 clergy in Texas just being in touch. We're trying to figure out how to expand the model that we created here in Dallas to Austin, San Antonio, Houston. The model is very simple. We gather patients filtered through the clinic who are the poorest of the patients. They have to qualify under Medicare, and they have to get funding from abortion funding sources. And we gather them, we feed them, we tell them that not all people of faith are anti-abortion, which they're all surprised about. We tell them the story about my church here, the First Unitarian Church in Dallas, which is where the Roe v. Wade case was started by the women of my church all those years back when Ann Richards was a member of this church.
That's right.
She raised Cecile Richards here in this church before she moved to Austin. that this church has always been a hot point for standing up for pregnant people's rights. And we tell them that story, and then we fly with them, and we just do pastoral ministry. And we're just there. The chaplains are just there for the patients all the way through the day. We spend 14 hours with them, and they're all kinds of people, just like they're always all kinds of people in the clinic. They're college students who if they have to have a pregnancy, are going to get completely derailed. They're mothers of three children who just holding on to a job and trying to keep their children fed. They're, you know, the whole human spectrum that you can imagine. Yeah. This is one thing I have to say about abortion patients is I've met thousands of abortion patients. They're 13-year-old girls who've been lured into relationships, and they're your friend's mother at UC at the high school, social, you know, like they're everyone in between. One in four women are having abortions in America. So, you know, in our history. So this isn't like a rare thing. So we take these patients, we walk with them, we literally guide them. Some of them have never been on an airplane before. All of them are very sure they know that they're doing the right thing. This is not, you know, there's not a lot of discernment, but there is a lot of family challenges. Some of them aren't telling their families. Some mm-hmm. of them have to take a day off and not tell their boss where they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, the pastoral ministry happens all the way to the end. And I told the story yesterday to a few chaplains that I spent the whole day, you know, with this group. And as we got off the bus back at the church at night, it was, you know, one patient said, "Will you walk me to my car? My boyfriend's on the other side of the building." I started walking with her, and she said, my boyfriend doesn't treat me very well. And I just stopped her and said, "So what are you going to do about that?" You know, here's a person who now has been freed by the abortion from the man who I assume was abusing her. Right. And now the choice for her was, now next what? What's next? And I said, "You know where I am. I'm here." And so the ministry doesn't just end at the end of that day. The patients are, you know, they know we're available to them. And so that's what it's like. I mean, it's a full long day of guiding people. Yeah. And it's not going to be the same all over the country. I'm talking to clergy in different states sure. about the post-Roe realities and starting chaplaincies in clinics and legal states, starting respite houses where people could rest. You know, if you have to travel from Idaho to Minneapolis, you're gonna need help. But if you have to travel from Bethesda, Maryland to or from Virginia to Bethesda, you can drive and come back the next day. So every state's going to have a different kind of situation. Sure.
Daniel, I'd like to, if you don't mind, I'd like for you to describe even another real life story or more that you've been a part of in this crisis, because I'd like for our people, I'd like for everybody to humanize the impact of these politically driven restrictions. I guess some know it and deal with it, but there are a lot of people who don't understand what all is going on here.
Yeah. Well, going back to the math, I mean, Texas, you know, annually would have done 60,000 abortions. And, you know, so if you do the math on that, and we're down to about 15% of that. The unseen story are all the people who are carrying pregnancies throughout that we're not meeting. And many of those are going to carry dangerous pregnancies. Many of them are going to be pregnancies they just can't handle. Some are going to be fine. You know, I mean, this is what the anti-abortion people always say. They always telegraph a prenate in a womb to their 30-year-old, you know, successful daughter. But we know that we don't know those potentials. We know that all kinds of things can happen. We know the potential we see in front of us, which is the real life human being. And I mean, there's so many stories, but on one trip that I took, I sat with a college student. Just imagine a a young African-American woman who grew up here in Dallas area, was a successful sports star, went to college, is a bright person, but had had a child when she was 16, you know, in the middle of high school, survived all that, is now in college, is trying to get her degree in biology or microbiology. And all of a sudden now, she, you know, one mistake, one, you know, we're talking about, you know, one little mistake with birth control. And there she is pregnant again. She has a choice, obviously, but the choice is derail college like she did in high school or try to pursue her dreams there. And this is a young person. These are 21-year-old, you know, 22-year-old people who have been through a lot already. And her choice is, and her right really around her body and beyond her body, her life. Yeah. You know, this is people's lives we're talking about.
Yeah.
She makes that choice that her potential is greater than the potential of the prenate in the womb. And if you can just picture this person, talented, bright, cheerful, already a mother, but is on a path to a new career, new opportunity, being derailed completely by a pregnancy with a person that she may not have any real relationship with or want a relationship with. You know, there's that. There's I've had patients with who have been abused. I don't know, but I suspect that there's a lot of incest patients who are not getting abortions. Imagine, because I've dealt with this in the clinic, imagine someone who's been raped by an uncle living in the same house, having to carry that pregnancy, birth that child back into the house where the abuser is. I mean, this is heartbreaking stuff. Yeah. And they have made the politicians have made no deregulation around this for things like incest. I know a lot of conservative people in Texas are actually quite worried about that issue.
Daniel, I'm interested in what are the lessons Americans living in other states need to learn right now from what Texas is enduring, especially folks who may be thinking, it can't happen here.
Yeah, well, it's going to happen in 26 states. So we know that there are a lot of trigger laws on these bans. What they can learn. So, you know, first off, for a lot of people, it's easy just to ignore this whole thing.
Yeah.
Just to say it's not going to happen to me and it's not going to be a problem for me. But that's a kind of privilege that we need to examine, especially as people of faith, thinking about what our responsibility is to each other. The second thing I always say is, this is not a simple black and white issue. I mean, these are complicated human life issues. People get pregnant. All kinds of people get pregnant. And yes, what's going to happen is, you know, there are going to be all kinds of different restrictions in different states. And people with resources are going to be fine. My friends here whose, you know, high school or college daughter gets pregnant is going to be able to fly themselves to New Mexico or New York. But this is a war on the poor. This is another version of war on the poor. You know, we hear Dr. Barber talking about this around all kinds of ways, but we have to think about this is a very clear war on the poor.
Yeah.
Because this is going to affect black and brown women largely who are poor. The states, the legal states, if your state's going to be legal, and you want to do something about this, activate your congregations and your ministers and try to get houses of respite for patients. Try to create channels between legal clinics and illegal states. Start advertising campaigns. We're working on all these things.
Yeah.
National hotline. We're working on all kinds of stuff. And if you're in illegal states, we're going to have to examine the laws because we don't know, you know, to what extent they're going to restrict our ability to actually do ministry with real people. And that's that, you know, we could be thrust way deep underground on this thing. And in the meantime, if you're a clergy person and you're a progressive clergy person. We're restarting the clergy consulting service, mm-hmm. which was the service that helped women get safe and legal abortions pre-Roe. So there's a national effort to start this service to help help people navigate these issues. And that's, they can find me. They can, you know, we can connect progressive clergy who want to be part of that.
I really would like for you to say a few words about the reason you feel called to do this work, because there has been such brainwashing of the public around issues of reproductive health and relentlessly implying that all religion demands absolute bans on abortion and on birth control. Could you just say why you are doing what you're doing?
Sure. Well, it's two things. It's the legacy of my congregation in these issues, that I stand on the shoulders of those women that fought for these things. But it's also that at heart, I'm a universalist. I believe that God created what God loves, and God loves all of us equally. And no human being is lesser than any other. And we need to honor that. We need to honor people's liberty, people's freedom, and people's, hard won decisions about the lives that they want to live. Yeah. So having compassion and justice as my guide, I continue to fight in these arenas.
The Reverend Daniel Cantor is senior minister and CEO of First Unitarian Church of Dallas and the author of the book Faith for the Unbeliever. He's been a leader in faithful opposition to the anti-woman laws and regulations flooding across Texas and likely coming soon to your state as well. Daniel, thank you so much for what you're doing. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Dr. Gaddy, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll come back anytime you want to talk.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, an award-winning documentary series, Raising Up the Prophetic Voices of Our Time. And later, a truly inclusive take on Lent and Easter. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. As we look at the chaos swirling around humanity right now, it's difficult not to long for strong moral leadership, something that often seems in very short supply now. In truth, that's something that'll almost never be as clear in the moment as it is in retrospect. Still, a powerful series of documentaries celebrating some of the leading prophetic voices of recent history can serve a helpful guide. That's why I am so delighted to welcome the award-winning documentary filmmaker of prophetic voices, Martin Doblmeyer, to State of Belief Radio. Martin, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Welton. I've been a fan of the show, and it's an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. The word prophetic gets used a lot more than it gets defined. Could we just begin with you defining this word prophetic?
Well, I think the most important place to start is to say the misconception too often is that something is prophetic, meaning that it's imagining what's going to be happening, like reading the tea leaves in the future. And the way that we're using this is not to say that. We're saying fundamentally that being prophetic means to be able to see in the moment, not towards the future, but to see in the moment what is, in fact, to our minds, the will of God. how God is calling us to behave, what is the moral path, which is not always clear. I mean, that's the biggest challenge that we all live in, is to try to understand what's the will of God and what should we be doing at this particular time. And we always have available to us, in the faith traditions especially, a wealth of people who can help us to some degree unpack the way that we are called to behave. It doesn't necessarily mean their situation and ours are identical, but often, because human behavior rarely changes, it's often the case that people who confronted those issues in the past, moral issues, injustice issues, they sort of shed some light on how we should behave in the current moment. And that's what we think of them in terms of being prophetic voices.
This word may be alienating to people outside of specific religious traditions. How do we make this idea accessible to everybody?
Well, I think the easiest way, for us at least, I can only speak from my own perspective, is we've been making documentary films for the last 35 plus years on subjects of religion, faith, and spirituality. And the basic centerpiece for everything that we do is something that we call narrative theology. And the basic idea is that we think that we can explore and unpack profound theological ideas, but do it through human story, do it through human drama. So to profile someone like an Abraham Joshua Heschel or a Dorothy Day, as we've done as part of this series, so it sends you down a path to understand who they were, the dramatic settings that they lived in, but then because we unpack some of the theological underpinnings for their lives, I think open up for people the opportunity for them to explore in their own life what are meaningful decisions that they have to make. Where are injustices, and what should I do in the face of injustice? So for me, this is a form of narrative theology that we get a chance to bring to a public television audience, a wide Main Street audience, and that's the fun of it.
Well, let's have you profile these people in these films.
Well, the current collection, it's a special collection, Welton, of five independent PBS-styled documentary films about five remarkable characters from the 20th century. And to my mind, the 20th century was the century where I think the best and the worst of humanity came across for everyone. We saw it in its best forms in terms of scientific progress, medical progress, but also in its worst forms, larger outbursts of anti-Semitic behavior and world wars that we can never forget. Yeah. So these were five figures that, to my mind, really were seminal figures in their day and can't be lost to us in ours. Abraham Joshua Heschel. The great Jewish mystic and writer, theologian, Dorothy Day, the Catholic social activist from New York City, New York, Howard Thurman, who was himself a mystic, but really the theological foundation for Martin Luther King Jr. and I think the entire civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Reinhold Niebuhr, who was the great public theologian of the 20th century. And before the first film that we had done in the series really was on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian who came to America and made this decision, the fateful decision, that he would return to Germany just before the beginning of World War II. And as a theologian and hopeful pastor, joined the resistance movement in the plots to kill Adolf Hitler. Mm-hmm. All five of these characters, so Bonhoeffer, Niebuhr, Howard Thurman, Dorothy Day, Abraham Heschel, brilliant writers. It's their writings that stay with us and will continue to stay with us, I think, for decades and decades to come. Yeah. That's how we know most of them. But when you start to unpack the story of their lives and the dramatic moments in their lives, the historic times that they live in, you realize that all five of them had in common one thing, an endless search for God, the meaning for God in their life, and what that actually propelled them to do with that insight in terms of social and political change that was required. All five of them, I think, knew that the easiest choice would be indifference, to do nothing, to sort of believe in your faith and to sort of have that between you and your God and then do nothing about the social and political realities that were so blatantly present before you. But all five of these people decided, no, my faith commitment tells me I need to do something about this. I can identify this and I feel as though God's calling me to do something about it. And what's really interesting to me is that I think in the case of all five of them, that their life path wasn't necessarily sure and prescribed or predetermined for them. They had to discover it themselves. You take someone like Dorothy Day, who I think is really one of the most fascinating religious figures of the 20th century, and maybe one of the most fascinating American figures of the 20th century, well beyond the sort of the religion constraints. And she took a while to find herself. She experimented with writing and the bohemian lifestyle. She was, I think, frankly, she was the classic example. I was once was lost, but now am found. Yeah. And it took until she was about 33, 34 years old that she actually found an anchor, something that she actually could believe in. And then from there, everything began to sort of unravel for her in terms of what she felt as though God was calling her to do. And from that point, Welton, she committed the next 50 years of her life to live in service, what she felt as though was God's service to others and the most needy. She built these extraordinary houses all across the country and now the world for people who were desperate. She was feeding the hungry in 1933 when America, after the Depression, in the Depression, in the center of the Depression, was desperate to create some kind of social relief for people. She didn't see it happening, and she decided on her own she was going to do something about it. Imagine a woman in 1933 on her own beginning this kind of a project, and then over the next decades, it just continues to grow. They were poor in every city in America, and so slowly but surely, the Catholic worker movement began to expand all throughout the United States and now even beyond that. So these all were people who tried to answer the bell, yeah, tried to answer what God was calling them to do, and really did it in remarkable ways.
I wondered what they had in common for you.
At the center of all of it is a common love and concern for how God was acting in their lives. That's the starting place for all of it. As I said before, all five of them were just terrific writers, mm-hmm, just really gifted writers, many of them writing in multiple languages. Yeah. Abraham Heschel is writing brilliantly in four languages. It's just remarkable. And Bonhoeffer the same. He wrote in English and in German. These were people who were brilliant writers. And also two people who didn't have power. I think that's right. Really one of the things that's interesting for me is in the traditional sense, these people did not have power. They did not have wealth, individual wealth. They did not have positions of government power. Positions of government power. But what they had in abundance was a sense of authority, moral authority. Mm-hmm. And that's why people turned to them and wanted to know what they thought about the particular political and social issues of the day. And that's one, I think, of the big differences between their times and ours. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, the mainstream media was turning to people like Reinhold Niebuhr, Abraham Heschel, Dorothy Day, Howard Thurman, asking them, well, what do you think about the concerns that we have around the war in Vietnam, around nuclear escalation, the tension between the United States and what was then the Soviet Union? How do you think about this? How should we think about this from a moral perspective? We don't really ask those kind of questions anymore. We don't look and turn to the moral voices in our culture. We look for the political voices, the economic voices, but we sort of have lost the interest and the appetite to bring a moral perspective to the issues that we're confronting today. And I think that's what these people were asked to do. That's why they became famous people during their own particular time. And I think a model for how we have to rethink about who we turn to confront the issues of our day.
Hmm. You know, so much has changed in our world in just the past few years. I have to ask you, whom would you most want to add to this collection from the current day?
Oh, that's a really good question. William Barber is one of the first names that comes to mind.
Yeah.
His Moral Mondays and his commitment to being modeling himself under the model of Dorothy Day and Howard Thurman, and I think also to Abraham Joshua Heschel. This is a man who has read his theology, understands his theological underpinnings, his foundations. I think Cornel West is another important voice in the 21st century that I don't think gets enough airtime. I invited him to be part of the Reinhold Niebuhr film and the Abraham Heschel film. He's brilliant. I feel honored to call him friend. And every time I've sat down with with Cornel West, I feel as though I learned a lot.
Oh, my.
And so he's somebody that I keep on my radar on a regular basis. And I think of myself as an advocate of Cornel West. So there are plenty of people out there, Wilton, that are that are available to us to bring a moral perspective. The problem is, I think the mainstream media doesn't quite know what to do with them.
Well, there's always a risk to raising up pivotal figures because it can discourage quote unquote ordinary persons from attempting extraordinary acts when the times call for that. You do a great job of humanizing your subjects and making their actions and decisions relatable. Was that a deliberate choice?
Well, it is, of course, because I think in some ways the fundamental message here is that, yes, these are extraordinary figures in their own way. But I think what they say to all of us is that each and every one of us, we're called to be sons of prophets and daughters of the saints. We have to understand that if we decide to live a life that we consider to be a life of faith and take us down that path of faith, that we're going to have obstacles along the way, that we're going to be days that we succeed and days that we fail. But we have models out there, people out there who went through the same exact kind of processes as we're going through right now. And I think if we're wise, we can turn to them and look at them as examples and possibilities. You know, I also want to say too, Wilton, that these were not perfect people. Their path to where they wound up was not straight.
Right.
Bonhoeffer, part of the making of the Bonhoeffer film was to say that Bonhoeffer struggled with making decisions in his life about which way he was going to go because he deeply understood the consequences for all of it.
That's right.
He did. And so, but his path was not straight. He took a while to find himself and decide what it was he was going to do. But he never failed to ask himself the fundamental question, which is, what is God calling me to do at this particular moment in time? And I think, frankly, in a social and political sense, that question's lost in our culture today. That's not the question that we're asking of many. We think of what's expedient, what's going to take care of our economic situation, where's our oil going to be coming from in the 21st century. We don't ask what God is calling us to do at this particular time in history. And I think that's exactly what they did. And I think that's why, at least I want them to be remembered.
What can we learn from the prophetic voices to inspire us in the decisions that we have to make?
Well, that's a great question. As I was doing the research and seeing some of the archival footage for the film, the last film in the series that we did on Abraham Joshua Heschel, I saw an interview that was done with him in 1972. He was being interviewed on NBC television by Carl Stern, the famous, the well-known reporter for NBC. And Carl Stern said, well, you've written these books, Dr. Heschel, on the prophets of the Old Testament. Do you consider yourself a prophet? Now, here is Heschel sitting on NBC television with a big, full white beard, big head of hair. He looks like Ezekiel come to life right there on the television
he
set. He does. And Carl Stern asks him, are you a prophet? And he sits back in his chair and says, no. I pale at the notion of what they did, but I consider myself undertaking the task to be a descendant of the prophets, to actually put myself in line of the prophets. Understand that comes with enormous responsibility. And so I think that's one of the things that each one of these people show us, which is that we have to accept the fact that we are descendants of traditions, that we have a wealth of study that's available to us in scholarship and thinking and experiences. And if we're wise enough to draw on that, maybe we can find some pathway out of the current crisis that we created for ourselves.
Well, tell our listeners how they can access the collection of films on Timeless Prophetic Voices, if you would.
Well, if they want to go to Amazon, you can buy the prophetic. It's called Prophetic Voices. It's a DVD series on DVD on Amazon, available on Amazon. Or come to our website, which is journeyfilms.com, JOURNEYFILMS.com. Because what we have at journeyfilms.com is not only accessibility to the DVD, but also to get it downloaded. You can download it at Journey Films, so you can put it on your tablet or on your phone or however you want to watch it. But we also have a lot of educational material that we've spent a lot of time cultivating that helps people use the films to teach them and teach it in congregations and seminaries and schools. And I, that's part of what we like to do, Welton. We say that we've made these films for the national public audience, but we think that they should hopefully can be really important educational tools going forward.
Martin Doblmeier, it's just an honor for us to have you on this show, and we hope to have you again.
Well, I'm honored to join you, and thank you. Thank you so much for what you continue to do. It's important work that you're doing, and so that's why we wanted to support it.
The season of Lent and Easter is the holiest time of the Christian calendar. There are different ways of celebrating this season, and there are reasons this is the season for bridging divides. Working on this from an inclusive, faith-based perspective is the Reverend Marion Edmonds Allen, Executive Director of Parity, a nonprofit dedicated to healing divisions at the intersection of religion and LGBTQ plus concerns. And I am just so happy to welcome Marion back to State of Belief Radio. Thank you again for being with us again.
Dr. Gaddy, it is my pleasure and my honor. So wonderful to see you.
The Lenten season starts with Ash Wednesday, a day when many Christians wear a cross of ashes on their foreheads. You've been a leader in the Glitter Ash Wednesday movement, and I'd love to have you talk about that.
Glitter Ash Wednesday started about 5 years ago. And it started when my dear friend, Reverend Elizabeth Edmond, who's the author of Queer Virtue, and I were talking. And Liz is very involved with street liturgy. She's interested in what are the ways that people can express their faith in the public eye, in the public square. And Liz came up with this fantastic idea to add glitter to traditional ashes. And we offered it to the public, and that it has just taken off from there.
What's the most memorable response that you've received for that?
The Glitter Ashes was intended 5 years ago as a way for LGBT Christians to come out about their faith. And that was the original intent. And Reverend Edmond, she developed a very nuanced theological basis for this, because we were aware that, you know, we're talking about an old church tradition that is beloved by millions around the world. And the last thing we wanted to do is to be disrespectful. So we presented it in that way. And what we found was that there were churches all over the country, particularly in rural areas, particularly on college campuses, that just grabbed a hold of this and said, this is perfect. This is a way for us to show that faith is accessible for all people. And we were thrilled about that and continue to be thrilled about that. And there are others who have felt offended by this. And my heart goes out to them, because that was not the intent. And as a Christian pastor myself, I mean, Lent is a holy time for me. So my heart is aggrieved by that. So we always try to share that, no, this is to show that faith in God is for every person in the world. Yeah. And I hear from folks that, oh, we've been doing glitter ashes for years now, for 10 years. And I kind of chuckle to myself, because this was the fifth year. And some people feel like, oh, we've been doing this forever. So that this is God at work in the world.
Hmm. My goodness. You're part of a team that assembled and released a series of Lenten devotionals. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, related to Glitter Ash Wednesday, it's a way for different people to be involved in the Lenten season. And often people's whose voices aren't heard. in the world. So we looked for folks who aren't published authors, and we asked them to write about scripture. And they did in beautiful and meaningful, powerful ways.
Hmm. It's so common for people to question the need for any kind of targeted LGBT-themed materials, be that in schools, lawmaking, or in religious contexts. I'm going to take a guess that you have an answer for that questioning.
I have many answers to that question, Dr. Gaddy. My approach to this question is that every single person should be able to have a relationship with God if they choose. And the fact that there are some folks who exclude LGBT people from church, or even horrifically say that God hates LGBT people. I mean, that thought to me gets me out of bed in the morning. Like, okay, what can we do? But I'm not alone. There are so many people who care deeply about this. And the studies show that over half of LGBT folks have a relationship with God, have spirituality, have a religious practice. So there are many of us out there. And the perception that sometimes people think, oh, well, LGBT and faith don't go together, that is the furthest from the truth.
Yeah, that's right. There is this terrible binary that's been created between LGBTQ identified and affirming people and self-proclaimed Christians who insist that they can't be real followers of Jesus. You specialize, thank God, in working at this complex intersection, and you've been remarkably successful at chipping away at stubborn ideological silos. What's your secret?
Well, this is God's calling on my life. So this is God's work, and I feel like I'm running to catch up with what God is up to in the world. What I have found is that the vast majority of people have loving hearts and have the best intentions. And sometimes they don't know the right words. Perhaps they don't know an LGBT person, and they just need someone to listen to them. They need to be able to ask their questions. They need to be able to feel safe in saying things and hearing reactions to that. So that's what I do. I just provide a place for people to ask questions. And then what I do is I ask them, what is there in your faith that will help you to better love LGBT people? Hmm. And then I watch the wheels turn as they think that over. Hmm. And that is something that I learned from my friend, the Reverend Kim Pearl, the Missouri pastor, mm-hmm. because in her holiness tradition, there are folks that long to love LGBT folks, and they know that they're in the pews, but they're not quite sure how to do that theologically. So they lean into, okay, how can we love? How does scripture help us love? And it makes all the difference.
Hmm. Marianne, I can't help but ask your counsel on this. As more and more states codify restrictions on specifically transgender identities and health care, what can you say to the parents who are caught in the middle? And if you wish, go ahead and speak to the communities that are being roiled by the kind of fear-mongering that we've been hearing so often from the lips of leaders who claim to be people of faith.
It's such a tough time in the world with these anti-trans bills out there. And my heart breaks for trans youth, for the families with trans youth. I have two transgender children myself. And what I have seen over the years, I have a background in working with LGBT young people, is that when there are these stories in the world of these anti-trans laws and different things, what we see is an increase in youth homelessness. We see an increase in suicide attempts. So this is very serious business. It's not just about a politician and a soundbite because they want to be positioned better for re-election. No, this is about young people's lives being put at risk. And so I say to the parents out there, there are so many people with you. There are so many people loving you, praying for you, working to be helpful in the world. And don't feel like you're alone. And to the youth out there, you are not alone. God loves you, and we do too.
I know you are involved in a number of initiatives in addition to the Lenten devotionals. Talk about what else you're putting out and help our listeners find these resources, if you would.
Oh, what a kind question. Another thing that Parity does related to the devotionals is called Holy Dialogues. And what that is it's an opportunity for people on all sides, as we say, of the LGBT and faith question, to be able to talk in a loving environment. We call it a curious and compassionate environment. So we have conversations together. Just this week, we started what we call a Converge group for LGBT faith-based folks to come together and just talk about faith, talk about being LGBT. So lots of opportunities for people to have a loving and sympathetic ear. We also have something called Blessed by Difference. You can see we have a theme where it's where I go and I talk to churches. I spoke with one last week, and I just was a loving presence so they could ask questions. So we do a lot of that. We answer questions. We offer a loving ear. And we offer advice when people ask advice of us.
Hmm. So what do we need to know about Parity, the organization you lead, and how can our folks get involved in supporting that work?
Parity was originally called Presbyterian Welcome, and it was started in New York City to work for marriage equality and for ordination of LGBT folks. And 25 years later, Presbyterian Welcome has been now rebranded Parity after marriage equality was achieved and ordination was achieved in the Presbyterian Church. And we do a wide variety of things all over the country, all over the world. We support a worshiping community of LGBT Christians in Kenya. And they just recently started a ministry with LGBT young people who have been excluded from school there. So we work all over the place and in a variety of contexts, and we are always looking for new ideas. So, Dr. Gaddy, if you have a wonderful idea, and I'm sure you have several, and other folks who are listening, please be in touch with us, with me, if you'd like to get involved with what we're doing, or if you see a need in the world that we could be helpful with. Go to parity.nyc, parity.nyc, and you will see our email address there and a phone number. Just be in touch.
The Reverend Marion Edmonds Allen is Executive Director of Parity and Director of Blessed by Difference. With unique gifts for building common ground at the intersection of ideology and inclusivity, Marion is doing invaluable work in a time of entrenched tribalism and division, all too often in the name of God. Marion, it's always wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio again, and know that you're always welcome here.
Dr. Gaddy, thank you. My pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company I'd ask you to share state of belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.